Fred Film Radio, Berlin International Film Festival, Germany.
Fred Film Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti. I'm in virtual company of Jason Kahn, director of Nothing Lasts Forever, screening at the 72nd Berlinale in the Berlinale special section.
First of all, let's start from the beginning of it all. So how would you describe your film? Would you say, as the synopsis recites, that it's a criminal investigation daring to deconstruct and accept the diamond and reconsider the creation of value itself? I thought it ended up being this, but how did it start?
All right, so in my mind, this was about the man who tries to save the diamond industry and ends up sowing the seeds of its potential destruction. Like, that was, to me, what it felt like, because when I met Duchon, I was already years into thinking about this film or thinking about the idea of synthetic diamonds, but I didn't know that there was going to be an actual story. To me, diamonds at that point seemed like a metaphor for a different story altogether. And it was going to be more similar to my first film, Mandabala, where there's two kind of unrelated stories. And Diamond was just going to really be a stand-in for another idea. And then, but I set up a Google alert for synthetic diamonds, because in 2003, there was this very hyperbolic Wired article that came out about these two American diamond companies that were going to essentially destroy the diamond industry, right? It was going to be over, so much so that I didn't even think that there was a movie to be made, but I was so curious about diamonds because of my family history. I grew up, my grandfather had this small store in Times Square in New York City, right around the corner from the diamond district. So the diamond world, this old Jewish world in New York, was always very, very intimate. And we knew people there and family, friends. It was always, diamonds were a big deal, and so, this article comes out in 2003. And also my one of my best friends and my partner on my first film came from a diamond family. And they were very involved with making Mandabala. And me not coming from any money and that money coming from diamonds that was helping make that film. There was something, it felt very personal. It always felt very personal. But nothing ever happened after 2003. The diamonds, these two diamond companies, continued. Actually, one failed and the other changed hands and got sold, but nothing ever happened. But I set up this Google alert, and then it was around 2013, I think, when Duchon wrote this article where they were being mixed, where he discovered that they were being mixed. When he discovered they were being mixed, that was the first time I was like, oh my God, this is like Blade Runner. This is totally this. Not only are there two things that are identical in the market, because they're, most people didn't understand that man-made diamonds were real diamonds, but there was this character, a scientific gemologist. What a great term also. I had no idea that they were gemologists, but he had to differentiate between these two things that were identical. Yeah. So it's like, here's this Blade Runner character, and it seemed like an impossible task. Nobody knew where they were coming from. Nobody knew how many had been infiltrated. The only thing that we'd ever heard controversial about the diamond industry was blood diamonds, which was obviously an extremely awful story. But it felt like we kind of knew that there were a lot of – that the diamond industry was really, really problematic. But this wasn't about the diamond industry in that way. It was actually about the fundamental idea of the diamond underneath, all of the other – issues involving the diamond industry. And so this felt like it became an investigation not only into this crime, but into what a fucking diamond is to begin with.
Yes, exactly. That's what I loved about. I mean, that's what I wanted to know, that when did you think that a documentary could be, the key not only to not only revealing what we're saying about the pureness of diamonds or the synthetic ones, but also a way to explore this idea of diamonds being, the ultimate symbol of love.
But that also goes back to my childhood, because, in 1993, there was a news piece on Primetime Live that I watched with my mother. And it took me years to find this piece of archival that's in the film. But I remember watching. I was around bar mitzvah age, right? And I'm sitting there with my mother watching on TV as this happens. And this is when Chris Wallace goes into this. It was right after the fall of the Soviet Union. Goes in this new Russian diamond vault, and it was the first time that anybody had been inside of a diamond vault. And the whole idea of this story was that diamonds were far less rare, far less scarce than anybody had thought. And I remember watching this, and we had this big conversation. I even remember vaguely my mother thinking, "Oh, it's all bullshit, right?" Like, but at the same time, my mother had cherished her diamond earrings. These were, my father had given them to her, even though that they were divorced. She still loved these heart-shaped diamond earrings. And she always loved them. This was a very precious object in my family and to my mother. And the thing that always stuck with me was that after this Primetime Live, where we both experienced this, like, vision behind the curtain, mm-hmm. she never, ever questioned the value or preciousness of her earrings. And that dissonance always stuck with me. And like, literally to this day, I feel the exact same thing. She still has her diamond earrings. Like, she still wears her diamond earrings. And I think she will always wear her diamond earrings. And even after watching this movie, of which she is extremely, as most Jewish mothers are, very proud of, she still loves these things. And so what I felt then, and I still feel now, is that, like, there is no fact or amount of data that can ever really destroy a good story. And the story itself was so powerful. And if you want to actually, let's say, end one story, you can't do it with exposition or information. You have to do it with another story. You have to create a better story or a different story, because stories are impenetrable to facts. And that was actually, I think, through the process of making this movie, what to me personally this was really about.
I have to say that I also loved, like, Aja Radin. I think it was genius for you to find her, and it was genius because she has this funny way and entertaining way to explain things. And also, I like that she's a woman. I know it's stereotype, but since we are the ultimate target for this concept of, love and diamond is forever, diamonds are a girl best friends and whatever. So I found that it was perfect. It was genius to have her to talk about these things.
So Asia is one of my favorite people in the world. Asia, we became very fast friends. She came in. She was the very, very last interview. Now, this isn't to say that there aren't women in the diamond industry, but women are by far a minority in the diamond industry. And where you'll find women working is obviously on the retail side and on the marketing side. But on the industrial side and on the synthetic side and on the gemological side, far, far fewer. So it was a big minority in terms of the characters that I was coming across in day-to-day experience while researching the film. It was actually in Martin Rappaport's hotel room when he was having that meeting that there was a woman there that Amanda's my producing partner, and I were in that room, and Amanda starts talking to this woman who is a second-generation jeweler, and she had read Asia's book, which is hilarious, called Stoned. Amanda read the book, and this woman, she recommended Amanda read the book. Amanda read the book. She said that I was going to love it. It's hilarious. I read the book. I loved it. It's fucking hilarious. I reached out to Asia, like, over Twitter or Instagram, and she happened to live in Los Angeles where I live. We had coffee, and it was so obvious that she's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life. She is so fast. She's so funny. And she agreed immediately to be in the film. And after that, interview, I was like, all right, we wrapped. We're done. Like, we finally actually have, you know, the voice that could say so many of the things that were, you know, difficult to say because nobody was willing to say it. Nobody had the courage to say it. And she had the inside experience. So, I mean, even though she's an author in the book, she is a jewelry designer because that's where all of her inside information and expertise comes from. And so it was very important, I think, to identify her as an insider in the industry rather than just an expert, although she's both. And she, you know, more than anything, was unbelievably courageous. Now, the funniest thing, though, was that my favorite part of her book was even before we so there was a period of time before we interviewed her. She has a one page footnote about her attempt to interview Stephen Lussier from De Beers and her failed attempt. and it's hilarious. And before we interviewed Asia, we actually, Amanda and I, with Eloisa, we went to Botswana and interviewed Stephen. And so coming back with that interview in our pocket and being able to talk to Asia about it, also made it feel so much more personal, right? You know, and it was, I don't know, it gave Asia the opportunity to comment on something that we had done in the film in a weird way. And I think that also gave a little bit of life and energy in a few moments where she's talking about Stephen, precisely because, you know, she was blocked from that experience 5 years prior when she had tried.
While I was thinking that it's connected to the Berlinale, how important is for you to participate in this festival that it's, I think, personally, I think it's perfect for your film because it's both a film festival, but also very active on the political and social side of it all, you know, through cinema.
So this is my first experience at the Berlinale. Mm-hmm. And to be completely honest, I was kind of ignorant as to the political profile of the Berlinale, you know, but at the same time, and I can't tell you why, but this was one of the only festival that I wanted to premiere the film at, you know. My first film premiered at Sundance, the second one at Toronto. But for me, that's actually not true. I know exactly why. Eloisa Passos is the cinematographer. She's a co-producer in the film. She's my longest filmmaking partner. I mean, we've been working together for well over 20 years. And this is Eloisa's favorite film festival. And if Eloisa says that this is the coolest film festival in the world, there's no question that this is the coolest film festival in the world because Eloisa is right about things, you know? And so she loves this place. She's had other films premiere here, and this was, you know, I guess over years and years of hearing about it, this was the place where I really wanted to experience. And you know, what, not, you know, being kind of completely aware of its political nature, I wish I was. I wish I was a little bit smarter in that, you know, in that regard. It was Eloisa said it was cool, and so that's where we're going to go.
That your film exactly the kind of film that I expected to find in Berlinale, and so I thought it could fit perfectly. That's why I asked. So, Jason, good luck with Nothing Lasts Forever
at the Berlinale. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for our talk, and hopefully next time we'll meet in person.
That would be lovely. I would love that. Thank you so much.
Grazie.
Ciao.
And we've been talking to Jason Kahn, director of Nothing Lasts Forever, in the Berlinale special section. And this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.